Greetings from the National Centre for Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Otago, Dunedin, New Zealand. We're one of the newest peace and conflict studies departments in the world, so it's very lovely to be able to join you all by video and greet one of the oldest peace and conflict studies departments in the world. I'm deeply sorry I'm unable to be with you all today. Nothing would have given me greater pleasure than to have been in the company of people who loved or knew Adam and who are gathering together to both celebrate his life and his 100th anniversary and also to remember the major contributions he made to the field of peace and conflict studies. This year, incidentally, on the 4th of July, which was Adam's actual 100th birthday, I did go out in his honour and find some locally produced ale, and I think I heard him say that it had been properly decanted and there was little sediment in the bottom. Anyway, I want to pass on congratulations to all the organisers of this commemorative conference, and I'm sorry I haven't heard what's gone before, so if anything I say is repetitious, please forgive me. For this session, I want to particularly thank Tom and John Paul for having produced such a wonderful commemorative book celebrating Adam's life and work. I also want to pay a special thanks to Judith and Martin Large, who have together produced all of Adam's poetry and a lot of his most recent written work, and this excellent book under the imprint of their wonderful Hawthorne Press. It's appropriate that Adam's 100th birthday is being celebrated with a symposium organised by the Peace Studies Programme here at the University of Bradford. While I'm sure he would have been chuffed if the Tavistock Clinic or Oxford University or Exeter and Harvard had commemorated him, I'm even more convinced that this meeting would bring him much pleasure, more pleasure probably, since this is where a lifetime's academic and practical work converged. This is where Adam started to think very systematically about sources of unpeacefulness and, more importantly, about how to heal a broken world. I'm sure that many of you will have deep personal memories of Adam. In fact, many of you will say, as I say, that he was my best friend, or think of yourself as his best friend. It was a measure of the man that he always managed to make anyone fortunate enough to be in his company feel that no one else in the whole world mattered at that moment. To this extent, he embodied Simone Weil's fundamental ethical principle, which is that the attention of another human being is the purest form of generosity. Adam attended to everyone in his orbit with this deep generosity of spirit and presence. Anne and Deb, Tina and Anna, for example, his immediate family, were always treated with the deepest and most absolute respect by Adam. But he accorded this family dignity and respect to all who sought his counsel, or to any friend who just happened to be passing by, or anyone who had the good fortune to be staying with the Curls. This generosity was particularly effervescent around 5 p.m. when, after Adam and Anne had their afternoon nap, he would pour his own homebrew beer into a gigantic white pottery jug and settle down with friends and family for lively pre-dinner conversation and not inconsiderable inebriation. Adam was for me, as for many of you, I'm sure, a mentor, a role model, a substitute father when I needed one, and a completely non-judgmental listener. He, along with my other mentors, Elise and Kenneth Boulding, John Burton, Herb Kelman, and so forth, were all wonderfully self-actualized human beings. But they were also excellent examples of what we now think of as scholar practitioners. They all knew that there was no point in just understanding the world. The point was to do what we could from where we were to change it in progressive and positive directions. And in doing so, and in all of their work and life and practice, they all set very high bars for us to emulate, and perhaps no one more than Adam. I won't talk in any detail about Adam's family life or his wonderfully rich biography, as I'm sure that Tom and others have either done this or will do this. What I want to do, however, is tag some of the events and people who shaped his philosophy, beliefs, and action, and reflect about the rich legacies that these generated. In the first place, Adam was brought up by a most unusual and gifted mother, and there's no doubt in my mind that this ensured that Adam always had a strong and unswerving faith in the transformative, healing, and integrative power of women. It was Cork who encouraged Adam to become a Quaker and a pacifist, and it was she, I think, who gave him the courage to be the independent free spirit that he was to be for his entire life. But it was she who also gave Adam that easy rapport with women and enabled to ensure that women were placed at the heart of much of his later peace-building work and practice. As he neared the end of his life, for example, Adam always said that he had much more faith in women peace-builders and women peace practitioners than he did in men, and I'm happy to concur with that judgment. Secondly, Adam's experience at home, school, and university ensured that he was always striving for consonance between his inner and outer lives, between the spirit that lay at the heart of his existence and the material forces that always seemed to threaten that spirit. He knew how fragile imagination, creativity, and the artistic spirit were in a world dedicated to greed, profit, and relentless growth. He also knew that to challenge the material world effectively required a deep spiritual groundedness. He believed in Shambhala warriors, that is, warriors who were motivated by a profound commitment to a whole life and an integrated life. And he knew something about the power of transformative power of whole and integrated personalities. As he often used to say when he was reflecting on his work in war zones and dealing with very challenging people, there was only one letter separating meditation from mediation. And that's why he prepared for difficult and challenging conversations with angry, hostile, and violent people with spiritual reflection, contemplation, and meditation. But it was this attention to the inner life, I think, that also gave Adam his unswerving belief that relationship building, both in terms of inner and outer relationships and inner and outer peace, was indeed peace building. Thirdly, and I think this is a theme that went through most of Adam's life, was a deep and lifelong ambivalence about power. He was born into a cataclysmic war that was initiated by deluded politicians, and there's no doubt in my mind that this generated a lifelong anxiety about power and the powerful. His response for that wasn't just to kind of speak truth to power. He argued that peace building at all levels required a diagnostic and a diagnosis of all relationships in terms of their political dimensions, and where these are dominatory, oppressive, or inimical to human well-being. He argued very strongly that they had to be exposed and opposed if we were to think about building a kind of a peaceful world. Adam wrote that there would be no peace or there could be no reconciliation between a slave owner and a slave. But he also knew that there could be no peace between an autocratic university administrator and democratically inclined faculty and students. Adam's writings on power, therefore, are at the heart of building peaceful relationships. There can't be any peace or reconciliation when actors are exercising arbitrary power over others. For peaceful relationships to flourish, we have to move from dominatory power to integrative and emancipatory power, from power over others to power with others. Well before contemporary critical theorists started talking about emancipation, as though it had just been discovered last year, Adam, Elise, and others knew that this was at the heart of everyday and extraordinary peace building. Justice, equality, and fairness, and participation in key decision-making are inextricably bound in Curlian peace philosophy. Finally, I want to comment that in all of this work, Adam was motivated by a profound Buddhist belief to prevent suffering wherever he saw it. This is pretty sage advice for anyone wanting to move into this field. Our motivation for analyzing violence and unpeacefulness is not to kind of add luster to our academic reputations and CVs. It's to develop effective, nonviolent, peaceful strategies for responding to those in need and for removing the sources of violence. It was to this task that Adam spent the final years of his life. In the Balkans and elsewhere, he understood that violence was being perpetrated by a wide range of actors, most of whom were not susceptible to rational solutions, most of whom were not acting out of rationality, but out of deep and bitter xenophobic emotion. In this environment, he knew that the first imperative was to stop and alleviate the suffering and confront those who were causing it. And the second imperative was to stop the violence on some permanent basis. And finally, the third imperative was to ensure that the world put in place conditions that would ensure that such violence never occurred again. In all of this work, Adam understood that there'd be no progress without imagination, creativity, and a generosity of spirit. These qualities, unfortunately, have been lost, and many of the departments that now teach peace and conflict studies. There's much more incentive to develop kind of scientific research and data on the causes of war and injustice. And I think in the process, some of the artfulness of peacemaking has been marginalized. I very much hope that this conference and those of you who are attending it will kind of pay a lot of attention to Adam's key insights and wisdom and place as much, if not more, faith in imagination and creative ways of healing a broken world as in promoting a variety of databases that document violence in all of its terrible forms. So I wish you all the best for a very successful conference. I regret that I'm not able to be with you. I'd love to be joining you at the bar, lifting a voice and lifting a glass and toasting Adam's 100th birthday. And best wishes for a very successful conference. Thanks very much.